Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. In today's segment, we have the honor and privilege of interviewing Mr. Anthony Fiora. He is the CTO and co-founder of Rootstrap, one of the top AI/ML software development companies here in the U.S. and Uruguay. Anthony, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Hey. Thank you, guys. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, let's go ahead and get started, please. So I'm at your LinkedIn profile, and before the show, I was telling you I was very, very, like, blown away by your certifications from some of these top schools in AI and machine learning. And, in fact, it seems like your whole background is pretty much in machine learning and computer science. Tell us about your background, some of the highlights of your career, and just how you got where you are today.
Yeah, totally. My background initially, it was, you know, very academic, computer sciences. I started with working on different companies like 15 years ago, and I started Rootstrap like a decade ago now. And initially we used to work a lot with startups, with early stage companies, and the company started to grow, and we were able to specialize more and work with some of the best companies in the world, very, very high growth companies. And in the last 4 or 5 years, you know, the demand for machine learning, artificial intelligence, really data sciences, big data, all these things together, it just started to spark my interest, and I tried to find the best resources and the best people that in the field. So that's how I got some certificates. I started to do more research work, try to, do some more innovation work and try to find out what's next, really.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Excellent. Now, with Rootstrap, what made you start Rootstrap? Like, what was your motivating factor? What was the catalyst?
We really wanted, it was back in 2011, and we really wanted to, provide a high-quality service at a competitive price for the American market. Our company is headquartered in L.A. and Uruguay. Those are our two main places, and now we're expanding to other places in South America. But, we wanted to be an alternative to the offshore agency model that was, if you can't really afford American companies, you have to go and find companies in Eastern Europe or in Asia, and you have, the time zone is not very convenient. You have serious, serious quality problems. So my great motivation was trying to bring together, a lot of engineering talent that I have on my network, and being able to provide to American companies high quality and very convenient time zones, very strong work ethics, and, culture compatibility, which sometimes is a problem with our countries.
Okay, excellent. Now, how did you get the name Rootstrap?
Rootstrap is the product of a combination of two companies, a merge of two companies. I founded the more engineering-oriented company. It was called Top Tier Labs. We were totally based in Uruguay, and my partner, David, he co-founded a company in the in LA. They were working a lot with entertainment industry, with celebrities, and they were like a design agency. They were doing workshops, not building things, but actually defining what to build. And at some point, we decided that, this is, we're stronger together. Let's combine our companies. Let's come up with the best of our both teams. And we merged the company. And, you know, Bootstrap is a way of modify the word bootstrap, which is what we're doing back in the days when we're working with a lot of startups.
Okay. Now, what is your role in Bootstrap and what do you do specifically?
I'm the CTO and co-founder, and in the last, my role for most of my time in the company was like a software architect, defining with our key clients what are the best structure, the best teams, the best architect to solve complex problems, really. And as we were able to grow our engineering team, bring some very, very talented people to the company, I started to change my priorities, and today I'm more focused on innovation, new technologies, research projects, really thinking a bit out of the box, and together with that, you know, you can ignore machine learning. I'm doing a lot of work with machine learning, with partnering with research institutions around the world, and trying to bring, you know, trying to predict what's coming next and trying to build the next step of our company.
Okay, excellent. Now, tell us more about your company. I think you said you have two office locations. If you can tell us that your employees and your market reach, do you have a global reach or are you more local to the U.S. market so far?
Sure. Yeah, we have around 200 people right now.
Oh, wow.
And our, I'd say that 120 people in Uruguay, around 20 in the States. We have a growing team in Argentina, and we just started to hire in Colombia. We also have a few other people in Europe, but mostly former employees that relocated to Europe, and they still work with us. Our clients, I'd say 95%, 98% of our clients are in the States. We have eventually, we have some other clients in the UK or other parts of Europe, but our main market is the States. And we go all the way from funded startups to enterprise clients. We worked with Google. One of our main clients is Masterclass, which is a pretty well-known unicorn based in San Francisco. And we do quite a lot of work in terms of verticals. We work a lot with education, with healthcare, and all kind of companies, from real estate to new entrepreneurs. We have a huge variety of projects and technologies, which makes it very exciting.
But within that grouping, what's your sweet spot? Like, which vertical or which industry seems to be needing your services the most?
We're growing a lot in the educational space, providing, you know, yeah, like providing services for like masterclass where, yeah, we have a lot of high-profile people giving courses online, and we have Emeritus, which is more oriented to universities and online certifications. We have lately we have been working a lot with also healthcare companies, dealing with a bit of the care ecosystem, which is quite complicated and it requires a lot of domain knowledge. But, you know, real exciting projects. Sometimes we have been dealing with genomics analysis. We have been dealing, you know, mobile apps, lifestyle mobile apps, everything that's related to education or healthcare. It's very interesting to us. And then we also have, you know, the more common, the more typical e-commerce applications with different types of scale. We have retailers, we have startups. I think it's we have cybersecurity companies that we work for. So it's kind of a mix, and we provide everything, you know, from engineering, design, strategy, domain knowledge, and what makes it really exciting and what makes it really valuable is that we bring these cross-functional teams, and we try to bridge the gap between business and technology. We always say that we don't want to really be builders, but we want to be technology partners, understand the businesses that we are in, try to prioritize with our clients. We have to say, no, we don't think this is correct, and this is why. And that's a big part of our work, you know, giving honest opinions from our experience, which can be right or wrong, but we have to speak up, and we have to partner with our clients, because if they succeed, we succeed. And this is what happened with most of our clients. With some clients, we started really small, and they became unicorns. And that's how we, you know, we went from one developer to 40 developers with some clients. We went from staff augmentation engineering to a cross-functional team of designers, product owners, product managers, engineering, you know?
Okay. Excellent. Now, tell us about some of your products and services at your website. I see everything from web development to mobile development, products, emerging technologies. Which, can you talk a bit more about each one, or?
About what, sorry? Can you go again?
Your product and your service line. I'm noticing you have like web development, mobile development, product strategies. Can you elaborate just a little bit more on a few of them?
Yeah, totally. Most of what we do is custom work, you know, which means we're not creating a product and going out to a market and selling that product to multiple people. We are, let's say that you have a company and you want to build a mobile app, and you have your strategy for monetization, you have your strategy for acquiring new users, and we bring first our strategy team, we brainstorm with you, we run workshops, we come up with a clear business canvas that we have to understand that the business model as well as the founder or the company. Typically after that we start some design iterations, we
you know.
Yeah, we have
people very specialized on UX, on UI, how the different flows, how the user will interact with a new, let's say, mobile app. And while this is kind of semi-defined or ready to go, we start our delivery process, and which is, you know, it's a living process. We rely a lot on feedback, on iterations, on early user testing. So we define a roadmap, and we start to execute. But, you know, changes in the business happen all the time. So we set up a process for our clients to iterate and maximize the chances of success. We set up, we put together this process following agile methodologies where, okay, we focus on value creation. We really define with our clients what's going to be built first, which is very important because it speaks to priorities. It speaks to what you have to validate first. And as early as we can, we go to market. We get feedback from early adopters, from users, from beta testers. It really depends on the project, the client, if it's a new venture or if it's an established company, if it has, if it's going through a big marketing campaign, we have to prepare for scalability in a different way, if we are just exploring or validating one market. So that's the type of work we do. We do custom development. We understand the business, we understand the model, and we put together a process to go through that journey. And in that journey, I mean, for more sophisticated companies or sometimes for early startups, really, we see a growing and growing need for machine learning capabilities. We see new problems that can be approached with machine learning, with data sciences. So that's why we are really focusing on creating these capabilities and thinking about the future. I mean, it's going to be it's already a huge industry, and it's going to keep growing.
Yes, that kind of leads me to my next question. So what is your experience with machine learning, and what are some of the main trends? See, my area is cybersecurity, so I'm seeing a lot of, you know, like headlines on machine learning used, you know, for task automation, for predicting, you know, the future, landscape, the threat variants. What's your experience with this, and what are you seeing in terms of future trends?
Something real important to keep in mind is machine learning is really, really good with patterns. Everything that that follows some kind of patterns or you can solve by the identification of patterns, it's probably something that it's worth evaluating machine learning to solve that problem. And you can find that in all types of, you know, industries. Probably if you think it could have started with, you know, the typical examples of machine learning is price optimization or recommendation systems, but it goes way beyond that. To produce some examples, in the cybersecurity or in the infrastructure side of things, there is something called ML Ops, which stands for machine learning ops. Which you know, the main idea behind that is to automate a lot of the work that is being done by DevOps today. A lot of optimizations, a lot of
monitoring, a lot of you can do anomaly detection to detect, you know, unusual behaviors, unusual patterns, detect hackers in a way that probably wasn't possible before. You can think that this same framework, this same way of thinking can be applied to many, many things. I'm real excited about everything that can be done in the healthcare industry and medicine. There is a lot of what physicians do today is about, you know, image recognition. It's about interpretation of data. It's about, you have many, many things that, and you have a lot of problems with regulations as well, but and that's the problem that has to be solved by the community, actually. But a lot of people, they are working on making machine learning able, capable of giving a second opinion or being an assistant to physicians or being able to categorize and diagnose faster and more efficient than ever before. We can think about having machine learning analyzing radiomics, MRIs, X-rays, ultrasounds, classifying, you know, what's a healthy tissue or what can be a problematic tissue or cancer. You can have machine learning trying to detect things that doctors might miss with the limited time that they have. We can have machine learning being able to process a lot of information or medical records that physicians don't have time to read in an appointment and make a summary. We can have so many things that can be done. You know, there is a huge trend now with known as conversational software, text generation. We are all very used to these chatbots that they work terrible, but there is a new generation coming. There are new technologies for understanding people, for generating a conversation, for generating speech, for recognizing speech. And there are new developments in all these areas. Even for what we do is we write code. A lot of our team members are developers, and there are a lot of machine learning innovations related to automatic code generation. So it affects every single industry.
Right. Okay, excellent. Now, are you working on things for like a Siri and Cortana, you know, like for the iOS and the Android systems? Our virtual personal assistants, can they be classified under machine learning?
It depends on how it's implemented. You know, you can implement a virtual personal assistant with more traditional approach to the problem, which means trying to categorize every single outcome, every single scenario that can happen, or you can model the very same problem with a more probabilistic approach, and that's where machine learning can make a difference, feel more natural, feel more human, and really learn from experience, and that's the other big thing. Using machine learning, you can create positive feedback loops. You can have what's called as reinforcement learning. You can, you can define a metric and optimize that metric based on the outcomes of the decisions that you take. So that's the that's really the beauty of machine learning. It can keep evolving, and a lot of that is built following more or less biological structures and how our brain works. So we're just starting, you know.
Right. Now, isn't it true, though, that machine learning is only as good as data sets? I mean, you got to keep the data sets optimized, right? You have to keep cleansing the data, you know, on a daily basis to make sure that the ML model grows. Is that correct?
That's, yeah, mostly correct. In some ways, I mean, data sets play a big role on having a really accurate machine learning model, and it's something that has to be professionalized more maybe, but the generation of data, the analysis of data, making sure that you don't have biased data, making sure they have enough amounts of data, is extremely important to have great results. And that's probably the most important and the most difficult part of the process. Because once you have enough data, it becomes more of a technical process, but collecting data, and if we think about healthcare industry, for example, you have all types of problems with privacy, with wrong mm-hmm. data, with data quality, and being able to collect data, being able to clean that data, make sure that you minimize the problems, being able to have enough data, that's the biggest challenge today, because we are dealing with oftentimes older technologies. Data is probably available, but you run into compliance problems. You have to you have regulations in the playing in the middle, which is fine, you know, because things can go wrong. But you know, if you have enough data, if you have the right quality of data, that's the most important step. And also, you have to create a way to, if you are within a reality, you have to find a way to collect data from the reality so you can improve your models, your machine learning models over time. And that's another thing. You have to, you don't have to think something is static, that you train and that's supposed to keep running forever, because reality changes, people's behavior changes, and you have to adapt to that. So that's the main takeaway, I think.
Okay. What are the different types of machine learning? What are some of the broader categories?
You can classify machine learning. Basically, you have three categories. You can say, we can talk about supervised machine learning, when you basically annotate all data. You have, you know, let's say that you want to create something to recognize if a photo contains a dog. So you have to take 10,000 photos, and you have to manually categorize those photos and say, this contains a dog, this doesn't contain a dog, And you have to train your model, you have to test your model, and this is kind of it needs a lot of human intervention. You need to and here there is a lot of data labeling work to be done that can be streamlined, and there are platform for that. But basically, you have to be on the top of that. That's supervised machine learning. Then you have what's called unsupervised machine learning, which is basically trying to detect, let's say that you have information about hundreds of, or thousands of people, and you can run unsupervised machine learning algorithms to categorize that people, and you're trying to find clusters of people that were not really obvious when you just looked at the people manually. You can start looking at, okay, what are the similarities, what are the differences, what makes this person more similar to this other person, and this has a lot of different applications from pattern recognition, behavioral analysis, analyze political biases. You can use that for marketing campaigns. And then you have the third category is what it's called reinforcement machine learning, which is basically creating a feedback loop, and you have to just the main thing is to define what is your metric of success and what you want to optimize. And then you have data coming from real life, and you have algorithms that take that data and optimize certain metric. It can be profit, it can be sales, it can be many things, you know. And all these different types, supervised, unsupervised, and reinforcement, they can be combined in different ways. In real life, you know, every single application that I've seen is a hybrid approach, really, a combination of different categories and technology.
Well, now, I love talking about algorithms. So in machine learning, what is it mostly just high-level statistics like using Bayesian and Monte Carlo techniques, or are there any other specialized mathematical algorithms in machine learning?
No, really, in the last years, we really created a lot of, different companies, mostly Google and community open source projects. They try to create different strategies, different algorithms that kind of hide a lot of the statistical complexity of running machine learning algorithms. So it has some pros and cons. On one way, it creates a new level of abstraction, which implies that you don't need to have a very strong mathematical background to being able to work with machine learning. The problem with that is that you don't have that background, and sometimes you run into problems that you don't really understand. And that's where a lot of problems like they are called overfitting or underfitting or many different problems mm-hmm. that can happen in machine learning when you don't really understand the statistical and probabilistic nature of what you are doing. So in the day-to-day, you are building on the top of libraries that have their own, algorithms, and they hide a lot of the complexity, a lot of the optimization. You have parameters to optimize, but you are not dealing with, Monte Carlo probabilistic problems usually.
Cool, excellent. Now, what do you see the biggest opportunities in machine learning, like in cybersecurity? Where do you think this is going to really work at? I mean, you mentioned healthcare. I think manufacturing is going to be a big one, but well, how about cyber?
I think that, I mean, every single industry that I see, I feel like there are major opportunities. I'm pretty excited about everything that will happen sooner or later with medicine and, you know, biosciences. I think that, but I think a lot of changes will come sooner to cybersecurity, for example. And it can have pros and cons, you know. We can have, we can have a lot of security problems being detected by anomaly detection, by non-typical behavior of users. We can have, the downside of that is that we can model a typical behavior of users. We can model based on the behavior, we can model his personality. And based on the personality, we can determine what are his next actions. And that can be used for marketing. That can be used for many different things. We have challenges with data. I mean, we need a lot of data to make machine learning work. And that data needs to be secured properly. So we need to create systems, we need to create data pipelines, we need to create privacy regulations that make sure that we are not we're not losing, I mean, for the sake of trying to create new and exciting technology with machine learning, we're not exposing data for a lot of people. So everything has pros and cons. We can detect all kinds of problems and do server monitoring. We can work with scalability. We can do cost optimization of servers with machine learning. But on the other side, we have to put all the systems in place so all the data that's being used is not being leaked to with malicious intentions, you know?
Okay, excellent. Now, just before the show started, we were talking about Azure and AWS, like using their VMs to, you know, harness the power of big data and machine learning. What platform does Rootstrap make use of, the Azure VM, the platform, or more the AWS platform?
We use, mostly AWS because, First of all, with most of our clients, you know, this is kind of what we think is the standard in this industry. It's powerful. It has a good for all the services that are provided, for the computation capacity. It has a reasonable cost. There are probably 200 services on AWS right now for different things, from data pipelines, machine learning databases, regular servers, clusters, anything, databases, NoSQL databases, a lot of different services for machine learning, like SageMaker, network services, storage service, security services. So it's a very complete suite of technologies, and so far, I mean, everything that we try to do, we find that it's one step ahead, you know? It's also Investing a lot of on IoT, edge computing, security, for us, it's you know, the most robust platform.
Okay, excellent. Now, who are the main players in the ML market? We see a lot of companies that they claim that AI is part of their, or ML is part of their product offerings, but are there any companies devoted strictly to ML that we need to keep an eye on?
Yeah, I think that we have to differentiate the companies that are creating the base technology, which is, you know, all the libraries, all the more sophisticated academic research, and the companies that use this other work as a foundation for real-life applications. So the first companies are usually the big ones, you know, Google, Apple, Amazon, OpenAI, Microsoft. OpenAI is it's a pretty impressive company. It's, you know, it's funded by Elon Musk, by Microsoft, between among others, and it has some of the most impressive technologies I've seen so far for NLP, natural language processing, text generation. Generation of generative models, which means that you can create images, you can create paintings, you can create music, you can create art, you can create anything that you want, and if you have enough training data, and it's all created by machine learning. So, to me, the most important part is to be up to date about what these companies are doing, what the big players that are creating the foundational technology are doing, what Amazon is doing, what Google is doing, what Apple is doing. Facebook is doing quite interesting technology as well, that they open source, the open source community, also has a lot of work being done, and OpenAI is always impressive. So those are the guys to keep in mind, in my opinion.
Okay, excellent. Now, who are the what are some industries that are going to be most directly impacted by ML? I know cybersecurity obviously is going to be one of them, but are there any others that we haven't talked about yet that will be impacted?
To me, it's hard to think about an industry that won't be impacted, you know. And it's being used nowadays everywhere. If you just Google something, there are many, many machine learning artifacts that were activated when you just did that, you know. And if I think about software development, it's going to be impacted pretty heavily. If I think about even, you know, the latest thing that a lot of people thought that machine learning could take over was creative work. And now we see that machine learning can in some ways, it's more a philosophical debate if it's creative or not, if it's machine learning doing that. But you can have machine learning just analyzing thousands of paintings from very famous painters and come up with a new painting and... Yeah, and you can't distinguish what was painted by a human being or what was painted by machine learning. You can have, and this was an experiment done, you can have machine learning analyzing hundreds of symphonies, and you can have machine learning coming up with synthetic music that mimics a symphony. and an expert musician can't really distinguish what was created by the human or by machine learning. You can go today to this website, thispersondoesnotexist.com, and this is mind-blowing. It will show you a photo of a person that was just created by a machine learning algorithm, and this person does not exist. And it looks real. It's creepy, you know? And this is one of the works from OpenAI. It can disrupt the entertainment industry, the cinema industry, music, all kind of creative businesses. It can disrupt healthcare, as I told you. We can use image recognition for many, many things. We can use things that used to take a long time and had to do manually can be done at scale right now. Right now, I'm involved in a project. It's a research project from it's a neurobiology institution that works a lot with stem cells. And you don't have to know a lot about, and this is the beauty. I'm involved in a project that basically there are some people, they come from a biology background, and they work with stem cells, and at some point stem cells they start to differentiate and they become neurons, or they become what they call what is called glial cells, which are another kind of cells in the nervous system. And what they do is they use a system called flow cytometry, and which basically aligns individual cells, and it takes a photo of each one of the stem cells. And today what they have to do is to go to a microscope and analyze each individual cell and categorize if they are becoming a glial cell or they are becoming a neuron. And part of the work that we are doing is we're taking this image, which is taken automatically by this flow cytometer, and we are categorizing if this is this stem cell is becoming a glial cell or if it's becoming a neuron. And that can be done at scale, you know, thousands every second, instead of having a person going to the microscope. And that can have a huge implication on the speed that researchers can be accomplished. And that's something that I don't know almost anything about biology. I have to learn a few concepts here and there. I have to learn how fluorescence works, or how a few other things work, or how a stem cell can be identified but you know, it's the very same foundational technology that can be used to detect a Dagny photo, that can be used to categorize stem cells, differentiating into different kind of cells. So I think the beauty is where you combine your knowledge, your computer sciences knowledge with other fields that are completely new to this trend, and then they just don't know the possibilities. You know? And a lot can be done in healthcare, and I think that can have huge implications for the future of how we all deal with our own healthcare.
Well, Anthony, it's amazing you talk about neurobiology, because you know what? My father, he was a professor of biology at Purdue, and his area was spinal cord regeneration, neural transplantation. And He was involved with the spinal cord regeneration, again, using amniotic fluid and stem cell research. And they say that he was on the verge of some kind of breakthrough using amniotic fluid, but he died of a heart attack, like, right before anything could happen. So that's amazing you're talking about. It's very coincidental, actually.
Yeah, I totally agree. And every single time that I work with a person that it's totally outside my field of expertise, I see that a lot of opportunities come up because these are areas that they typically don't know a lot about the capabilities of all these new trends or about what machine learning can do or about how we can process a lot of data with big data approaches. And I think that the magic happens when you combine and you really create cross-disciplinary teams. You don't have to know a lot. You have to understand the basics, which is not that hard. And once you do that, you can totally work with people from totally different things and come up with something totally unique. Because we are not really interested on, keep building recommendation systems or price optimization, which is a typical use of machine learning, but we can do way more than that.
Yeah, excellent. Now, do you have any ethical concerns when it comes to machine learning? I mean, here in the U.S., everybody's worried about Big Brother watching, privacy rights being violated, civil liberties. Are there any ethical concerns about this?
Yeah, I think that ethical considerations are a big part of the debate that has to happen. When we work with medical records, I work quite a lot with medical records. When we work with genomics, we have to make sure that all data is anonymized. We can know way too much about a person having access to their genetic data, We have access to genetic markers. We can be associated with personality traits, with things that people like or dislike. With a lot of this it can be affected by the environment, but many things are affected by genetics. So we have to put systems in place that make sure they have the right privacy. On the bright side, we can prevent diseases. On the dark side, we can give away this data to people that can exploit this information about these people. So that's a big part. And there is another big topic that concerns me. There is a big concept in AI, which is explainability, By explainable AI, you can define explainable AI when you can clearly define the criteria why a machine learning algorithm came up with a certain response or certain recommendation. But a lot of algorithms that we use today, they don't rely on explainability, and they can be more powerful. And sometimes you can run into a dilemma, And if you want to go, if you think about regulations, if you think about the FDA, everything that's going to be applied for medicine probably has to be explainable. But it raises a question. If you have two recommendations for treatment and you know that one recommendation was generated based on the analysis of millions of treatments and outcomes, and it's not explainable. Let's say that your combination of chemotherapy treatments and that recommendation came up from a machine learning system that's not explainable. And you have another recommendation, which is likely less effective, but it's totally explainable. And you can, and your physician can explain, okay, we're giving you this chemo and this combination because you have these genetic markers and these characteristics. Which one would you choose, you know? Probably, if you think about probabilities and if you think that you can have an unexplainable AI that analyzed millions of cases, that's the one that will increase your likelihood, you know, your chances. But in terms of regulations, you need an explainable AI that maybe it's not so effective. So to me, that's an open question. That's an open question. I can't really answer that myself.
Well, Anthony, one thing that I've come across when it comes to cybersecurity and security issues are the creation of deepfakes. That's basically when you can replicate, like, a real-life person that make it look, but it's fake, but it looks almost the same thing. What are your thoughts on that? Has machine learning been used for that, or is it more of a realm of artificial intelligence?
Yeah, I mean, machine learning has been used, and it has been improving that, and it will keep improving that. If you combine video generation with voice generation, and you can create a very, very realistic deepfake, which can be dangerous, you know? You can build that with good intentions. You can build a platform where you license, you know, a celebrity image, and you can use his deepfake with his authorization for marketing campaigns, and he doesn't have to record videos for you, and it can be done at scale. But it can be done with very, very, malicious intentions. It can be done it can cause political problems. It can cause, you know, even diplomatic problems because they are so convincing. I think that the most people will keep doing that, and that's something we can't avoid. What I think has to happen is that more and more people work on machine learning approaches to recognize deepfakes and embed that technology on every single social network. You know, if we have a politician saying something which is a deepfake in a social network, ideally that has to be tagged immediately. And I don't know if if that's something that has to be banned, I don't think so. But people have to know that this is a deepfake.
I try not to get political on the podcast, but I personally think it should be banned. But that's just my
You can come up with good reasons for that. To be honest, I don't have a strong opinion, but I can come up with good reasons for both approaches, you know? Either ban a deepfake or let it go, show that, but making it very clear that it's a deepfake. And I think we all these big players, they have the technology to detect, and it can be at the end of the day, you know, a technology race where deepfakes can become more sophisticated, and deepfake detectors they have to catch up.
Right. Now, in terms of data feeds, here's another question that was always intrigued to me when I was writing my book. Where do you get the data feeds from? Now, obviously, you just can't like download everything on an Excel spreadsheet. I mean, we're talking about terabytes of data. So, where do you get the data feeds from, or where can you get them for an ML system?
Data. Yeah, there are many different places, you know. A lot of data is available. Most of this, you know, it's non-sensitive data that it's made available by different companies or by different institutions for research purposes, for different things. You typically, if you are going to work for, let's say, a healthcare provider, you have access to that data. Obviously, after going through some processes for maintaining privacy and everything that has to happen in those cases, but usually it's very domain specific and. It's a combination of domain-specific data sets, which can be either public or you know, companies can aggregate data. A lot of data can be scraped from the internet, from public websites, and you can train on that data. It really, really depends on the problem that you're trying to solve. And it starts with the problem, then you try to find the best sources of data to create something of value in that area. And finally, you know, the other approach is generating that data. I mean, let's say that you have a golf coach, and that will help you to play golf better. And you can have pro players recording all their movements, and you can record their videos recognize where is his elbow, his knees, the angles, and you can collect all this data and use this data to create your golf coach app in the future. So that's kind of it, you know. Public data, company data, or create your own data.
Okay. Now, as I mentioned, cybersecurity, AI and ML are being used there for like task automation. You know, like for example, suppose you're doing a penetration exercise. There are a lot of tasks that are in between that need to be done. They're mundane and they're routine, and they're just really a waste of time for the pen tester. So they're learning to automate those processes. But with this issue of automation is now the problem and the fear of ML not taking over human jobs. Now, is this a real issue, or is it just something that's exaggerated by the media? What are your thoughts on that?
I think that we are moving toward a reality that will automate as many things are can be automated. We had transformation processes before, and this one might be a bit different because of the speed that it happened. I do think that a lot of jobs are going to be automated. A lot of it can probably create some problems, but it also creates many more opportunities. So I think that at this point is unavoidable. It can be painful, but at the end of the day, it will be worth it. I mean, we can solve problems in ways that we don't know today that we're going to be able to solve. We can improve our quality of life. We can improve our health. We can improve. We can predict our problems. I think that the benefits are much greater than the pains, but I think that there are going to be a lot of pains. And we see every day, you know, all things that are being automated, and that's a trend that will keep accelerating.
Okay. Now, we've talked a lot about the potential for machine learning. What are the limitations of machine learning, in your view?
That's a great question. I believe that what we used to think were limitations are no longer valid. I don't see a theoretical limitation to the types of problems that can be solved with machine learning. I think that the biggest limitation is data, you know, quality of data, data biases, make sure that machine learning is not creating more problems that it's solving. But I can't really think about a problem that it's totally outside the scope of what can be achieved. Maybe not today, but a decade from now, you know. Even, you know, creative, all the creative work, art, music, everything can be impacted by machine learning, and a lot of that can eventually replace people. We don't know how this is going to end, but I see a lot also probably a convergence between IoT and machine learning, a world more, we are going to get more used to different kind of sensors, we are going to get more used to different kind of automation, which is software, it's machine learning, it's algorithms that are running that you don't even realize. It can go, you know, like predicting what you're going to do next, what your preferences, what you want to eat today, what you want to, when you want to go to the theaters, and a lot of that can be predicted in a very accurate way, and you know, it can be more proactive and less reactive.
Okay, excellent. Now, Anthony, in cybersecurity, there's a lot of confusion, and the two terms are used quite a bit synonymously with one another: machine learning and artificial intelligence. Now, what are the parallels between the two, and what are the differences between the two?
You can think about artificial intelligence as a technology which consists of having a machine simulating human behavior, and you can think about machine learning as a subset of AI, which allows machine learning to take decisions without being programmed explicitly, you know. When we think about, let's say that we have a photo of a dog and we have the problem of deciding if it's a dog, we can we can write some AI. It's AI, but we can write a program that try to identify certain pixels and try to identify certain characteristics of a dog. And that's AI, and we can do that manually. But if we have a machine learning algorithm that you trained with 10,000 of photos where you said, this is a dog, this is not a dog for all these photos, and then you let your algorithm infer if the photo has a dog or not, that's machine learning, because you are not programming explicitly. You are relying on data analysis. You are relying on, different types of algorithms that it has a mathematical and statistical foundation, but is not explicit. So basically, AI is simulating human behavior. Machine learning is a subset of AI where you don't program that explicitly.
Okay. Now, another field of AI is computer vision. And I've done work in biometrics. In fact, when I first got started in security, I was in biometric technology. Computer vision is now they're trying to use computer vision in conjunction with facial recognition to make it more intelligent. For example, identify people more in real time. Facial recognition obviously has its flaws and everything. Has Rootstrap or have you personally done any work in computer vision?
Yeah, we have. It's a pretty fascinating field. The neurobiology project I talked a few minutes ago, basically it follows the same it's the same problem that we have sometimes classifying photos of, training photos of this is an animal, this is not an animal, and we are doing that with stem cells. And basically the way it works, they are called convolutional neural networks, which are designed to detect patterns in images. They are not analyzing each pixel as an entity, as a single individual, but the main consideration is that there are clusters of pixels with meaning, which is a pattern. And this kind of neural networks, they are typically used for computer vision, and we're using that for categorizing stem cells. In a recent project, we have done that for recognizing objects from images, drone images, taking this company, they have drones. They take photos of different cities, and they do different kind of repairs, and they work with they do underground work, they work with pipes and different kind of things within the cities and the street, the sidewalk, and they had all these images, and our goal was to recognize objects within that images. This is a tree. This is different kinds of things that you can find in the street. This is a house. This is a small fire drill and different kinds of things that you can identify in the street. And basically, there are two main approaches to that. You can do object detection, or you can do image segmentation. Object detection is like I told you, like, okay, we are going to find an object in certain coordinates, and we're going to label that object, and we're going to create a file with, okay, this object is in this coordinate, or we can use image segmentation. Let's say that we have a photo of a forest, and you have fires in that forest. You have wildfires, and you can segment the image between, okay, this is the part of the forest that is healthy, and this is the part that is suffering from these fires. And you can very quickly create masks and differentiate what is basically class A, which is healthy forest, and what is class B, which is ongoing fire, and you can have class C, which is, you know, the fire already, we don't have fire here anymore, but we have ashes or we have smoke.
Okay, excellent. Now, Anthony, another term that's often misunderstood is big data. That's another term that's thrown around quite a bit, even in cybersecurity. How do you define big data? Does it simply mean you're dealing with large data sets, or there's some high intrinsic value with the data? How do you define that?
This is big data has been for quite a long time kind of a catch-all, you know, phrase for a lot of things and a buzzword which was sometimes oversold. If you go to the definition, it's about having big data sets, a lot of data, which can be static data or can be data coming from different sources in real time. Let's say it really depends on the problem. Let's say that we have a platform with hundreds of servers, and all the log generated by all the servers, they are sent to a centralized monitoring system. This system is dealing with big data because it has a lot of data coming in real time all the time. But the basic definition is more about volume. If you have a lot of volume, you have big data, and you usually want to do something with that data. And that's when you have all these different technologies to work with big data. You have data lakes, you have big data databases, you have stream technologies, you have real-time processing systems, you have ETL, which stands for when you have a data input, you do some transformation with that data, and then you group that data in a certain way because you have, let's say, a dashboard where you aggregate a lot of data. So it's big data really is dealing with a lot of data, and sometimes when you have machine learning, you have to deal with big data, and you have to train your models with big data. You have to build an architecture and an infrastructure to be able to obtain this data from the data source, which can be one of different things. You have to build your infrastructure to process data. You have to build your infrastructure to, you know, have some data quality metrics. You have to train your algorithms with new data that's coming in. If you have some kind of reinforcement learning, or if you have more data, you want to retrain your algorithms. So all this requires quite a lot of work. It has to be done at scale. It's usually decentralized. It relies on different technologies, and we use a lot of Amazon services for that.
Okay, excellent. Now, finally, Anthony, as we wrap up our show here, what are some of the other data science projects you plan to take on with the Rootstrap?
Yeah, that's a great question. We are very excited to take any, we have two main focuses. One is we have been working quite a lot with medical records, medical history, and we have a lot of domain expertise, and I see a lot of opportunities within that area. We are working with research projects that are not necessarily for profit, but it generates a lot of academic knowledge. It generates a lot of, it brings us reputation because it we solve complex problems. And if we can apply that to neurobiology, we can apply that to many other areas. And we see a lot of opportunities with computer vision, and every single time I have, a computer vision project in front of me, I'm pretty excited with that. And if we can work with a combination, of computer vision, big data, healthcare, genomic analysis, object recognition, those are all things that we can do very, very well.
Excellent. Now, Anthony, what is the best way for someone to get a hold of you in case they have questions or they have a project they want you to work on? How should they contact you?
We have our website, rootstrap.com. My personal email is anthony@rootstrap.com. And also we have our email, hello@rootstrap.com, where you can get in touch with our sales team with if you have any projects, any questions about how we work. And I usually available, LinkedIn, and real excited to participate on any conversations or conferences or just talk with like-minded people.
Excellent. Anthony, thank you so much for your time. As I said before, I could have multiple podcasts with you on this topic. It's really fascinating for me. We look forward to having you again in the future.
Perfect. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a great day, okay, and have a good summer.
Thank you. Likewise.
Take care. Bye.